All right, welcome to the Voices of Worker Shanty podcast. It's been a while since we've met, but we're back again, and we have a series of really interesting podcasts lined up for you, the listener. And today we have a really great one from Axe. He is one of our classmates at the New College, University of Edinburgh. So why don't we let you introduce yourself, Axe?
Hey, Charles. Yeah, thank you so much, and Shu, for having me on the World Christianity Podcast. I'm a Polile. I go by Axe. I'm Xhosa from South Africa. And I'm doing a PhD in New Testament and Christian origins. I'm looking at the problem of animal sacrifice, or the dilemma of animal sacrifice among Xhosa Christians who still offer sacrifices to their ancestors today. And I'm questioning whether Christians should be participating in this, considering Jesus' sacrifice on the cross.
Thanks for that. You gave a presentation a few weeks back, and in the presentation, you talked about some problems, specifically four problems related to animal sacrifice. And I wonder if you could just name them, and then as we go on, you could probably elaborate on them further. But what are the four problems surrounding animal sacrifice?
Great. Yeah, so I gave this paper at the World Christianity Seminar, and this is how I was invited. And basically, there's actually five problems, but for the presentation, I kept it to four. I should have kept it to three, but they say odd numbers better, but I try to stretch it a bit. But the first one is basically, how do we reconcile the role of ancestors in the animal sacrifice, questioning how animal sacrifice is basically directed to ancestors. And then the question of cultural religious traditions, which are passed down from generation to generation. How do we negotiate cultural religious identity or indigenous religious identity when we convert to Christianity? Does this mean we abandon practices like animal sacrifice when we convert? Are our previous spiritual beliefs towards the sacrifice of the ancestors idolatrous? So I raise questions like that as well. Mm-hmm. And the third one is then the significant role of ancestors in the context of animal sacrifice. So how ancestors are mediators between God and humans. So sacrifices are directed them in the hope that pollution or anything that negative happens will be averted. So then the third issue, well, that's the third one. And then the fourth issue, the one final one I discussed, was the idea of resurrection, mm-hmm. and Christian resurrection and the Messiah's sacrifice. So how Jesus' sacrifice, he dies on the cross, and then 3 days later he rises again. And you see in Revelations and Matthew how this is future eschatology, or where Christ is going to come back and will be resurrected. But Xhosa people have interpreted it very differently. They've interpreted a more millennial,
right.
Yeah, you know, sorry my pronunciation there. But like basically an imminent resurrection, not one that happens in the future, but one that will actually affect creation now. And this is situated in the colonial context of the pending British invasion and the epidemic in the 1800s with the national cattle killing. So you sort of see in that example how resurrection had a more present day effect and not some future one.
Right.
So that's it.
So it's the problems are essentially, firstly, related to Christ's sacrifice. Secondly, it's related to how to relate to cultural traditional practices. Thirdly, relates to ancestors. Yeah. And fourthly, it has to do with resurrection, right?
Yeah.
It's probably worth...
Yeah.
Right. It's probably worth backtracking a bit. And can you tell us what exactly is entailed in the animal sacrifice practices? And maybe that might give us a view of why these four problems exist.
Yeah, so animal sacrifice is a very it permeates in so many traditional indigenous practices, like when a child is born, a sacrifice is made to welcome the child into the family. So newborns get a sacrifice and they have to eat a specific part of the goat or the sheep. And there's a whole ritual process towards the whole sacrifice. Sacrifices are made in the kraal, which is the cattle enclosure. It's like the sacred space between where the ancestors reside. So the presence of you to be there. And so when a sacrifice is made, we will do it in the kraal or the cattle enclosure outside. And the animal must cry. Once the animal cries, it actually shows that the ancestors approve of the sacrifice. Mm. If it doesn't cry, then it's seen as they're not approving of the sacrifice. Mm. It's interpreted in that sense. And sacrifices often involve sheep, goats, cows. And then you have sacrifices for rites of passage. So it permeates in every sphere of life, in rites of passages, in when someone passes at the end of a mourning period. You also have another sacrifice which acknowledges the mourning period. So there's different meanings and reasons why animal sacrifice is performed. Those are just a couple of examples. Mm-hmm.
So I think from what I see, there's a functional aspect of the animal sacrifice in just the basic function that it provides food, and it provides some way of celebrating some event in one's life or in the life of the community. But also, I think it also seemed to be tied to ancestors, relationship with the ancestors, and some kind of mediation that the practice has in mediating between spirits or even ancestors. What strikes me as I listen to you and as I listen to the seminar paper a few weeks back and as I listen to you today is just the question, how is it that Christians, and just to be sure, these are Christians who are already Christians who are still practicing animal sacrifice, right? And for me, my question is how do they reconcile these, what seems to be huge contradictions between Christ's sacrifice and what the Bible seems to say, the end of sacrifice, and then this ongoing practice of animal sacrifice that is being practiced in this people group. Could you just comment a bit and try to help me grapple with this?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. And I think that's actually a question I had growing up when we were doing all these traditional rituals that include animal sacrifice. I'd always question, if we worship God, then why do we worship ancestors? And so it was a bit of a dichotomy. And so there's, we lived in Johannesburg and we'd always go down to the farm, the rural areas. We also did sacrifices in the urban areas, especially when we're opening a new house. And my dad purchased a new house, he had to do a ritual to welcome the ancestors and to feast and fellowship together in the city and everything. But when we would go home to the farm as well, there's this tension of maintaining amasiko, which is cultural religious or indigenous religious traditions. And it's this whole idea, this is who we are, we have to maintain our identity. And you sort of see the tension when people convert, of whether they continue doing these practices or not. And it divides families, in the rural areas. Yeah. I mean, you have relatives or even people who try to do both, who try to negotiate both. Others transform the meaning. Maybe they say, we do this for food, for fellowship. And the symbolic aspects shouldn't be viewed as or uplifted because Jesus is our ultimate sacrifice. And so it differs. I wouldn't say there's a monolithic way. I think people take it the way they see it. And one comment I'll never forget when I was young, when I questioned this to one of my relatives, who's actually an ordained reverend, an ordained Presbyterian minister, and he would say, if we would choose, we wouldn't be allowed to do this, but we are Xhosa. And so that cultural distinction made me think about it differently, right? Like, okay, there's a cultural aspect of who I am, which is Xhosa, but I have this faith, right? So how does this faith transform this cultural identity? I'm not now meant to just be a Jew. Does it make sense? Is that whole idea of, it's like Paul's position of the Gentiles has not been solved, right? we're still trying to comprehend how we as non-Jewish people,
yes,
what should we do and not do, right? And so, I think people are figuring it out as they go.
That's right. So I think in terms of the functional aspect, it makes complete sense to me. I'm from northeast part of India. I belong to the Naga people. And for us, when there's a celebration, I'm reminded of what one Naga young person told me. And he literally said this to me: if there's no pig or buffalo slaughtered, then it's not a celebration. And in that sense, the slaughter of animals is a crucial part of the celebration. But it's not necessarily perceived as animal sacrifice. Although, to be accurate, there's actually an animal that was sacrificed, but doesn't take on the whole animal sacrifice kind of language or understanding. So in terms of the function that animal sacrifice plays, I think it makes complete sense. But it's quite interesting to hear also about the what we may call the theological or the spiritual angle towards it.
Yeah, and that's interesting to hear that, because that's the argument, right? Especially when we move into the city, when you talk about the regional the different area spaces. In rural areas, people will tell you they don't have obviously shops, right? Or they do have some smaller shops, but they have these spaza shops, these nice small shops where they sell snacks and stuff. But then, like, when you talk about meat, they're farmers, so how does the meat arrive at your table?
Yes,
you sacrifice it. But then you go, I'll never forget, like, we had a ritual in the city, right? And then there was this whole debate. People were arguing, like, no, we mustn't buy meat from the shop. We must go to the butcher and see him cut it. And you're like, what?
Yes.
Like, but we're in the city. Come on, we're not in the rural area now. Like, we're in the city. We should do city things. And people are like, no, but this is an important ritual. And this is not even like a big one. It was like a celebrate. If someone had finished their rites of passage, a boy had become a man.
Right.
So we were celebrating. So it wasn't really a big deal. Like, it really wasn't. We could have really bought meat from the shop. Like, it's okay. But people are adamant. And so, like, my dad ended up buying a whole lot of sheep. And I'm like, but really, like, just go to the butcher. We can buy more meat. Like, I don't know, like, why we have to. There wasn't even like a need for the animal to cry in this situation because it was just a celebration for the end of a rite of passage. The boy now is a man and let's all feast. And, you know, so it's interesting how, like, in different spaces, even though it's in Africa or in South Africa, and you're talking from South Asia. So it's interesting, right? Yeah. Like, it's interesting.
I would like to just divert the conversation to more of a theological question or more of a religious beliefs aspect of the question. And can you elaborate a bit on who or what are involved? What deities, what spirits are involved in this whole dynamic? Is it just ancestors? Are they spirits? Is it just animals? Who or what is being appeased in this whole rituals of sacrifice?
And so that brings you into Xhosa cosmology and the whole complicated system that a lot of African scholars have tried to explain. So generally, we go in the threes. You've got gods, you've got spirits, good and evil, and you also have ancestors who even have different levels, which can get confusing. Like, after a couple of years, an ancestor becomes a living spirit.
Right.
Yeah, it's very complicated. But in from a Xhosa perspective, from what I got in my upbringing, it was that ancestors are mediators. And scholars, Xhosa historians, often argue that the mediation role of ancestors is a Christian, is a product of Christian influence. I disagree with that, I think, to an extent, because if we look at even pre-colonial sacrifices directed to the deity, which again is complicated. So we have two names for God, right? Or we have a lot of names for God. But in terms of Xhosa Christians, there's this big debate between the two gods, Pamata and Tito. But because Xhosa people are Bantu people, we also have other names like Umdali, Udali Wezulu, the god of the sky, right? So it's the supreme being. So in sort of Xhosa and Bantu cosmology, you have the supreme being, and the supreme being's got spirits, or the spirits. Spirits, the thing is uncontrollable. They can cause you harm. And in some African societies, sacrifices are also made to appease evil spirits. So it's very complicated. But among Xhosa people, the tribe, my ethnic group, it's mainly directed to ancestors, which is complicated in itself, because you would say ancestors or abantu bangaphansi, indlozi, you know. There's so many names, even praise names ascribed to it. And if you translate some of those praise names, it's like the living dead, the living beings, you know. It's even spirits. So then it gets complicated. Like, okay, are they also spirits? Do they become spirits? You know, so, but yeah, basically it's mainly ancestors that are being appeased, who are seen as mediators. But in some cases, even in pre-colonial times, you have sacrifices that are to the god, the supreme being, directly as well.
So Ax, could you tell us a little bit about, in your paper, you have this, and you did talk about it during your presentation, but the different names for God, you have Thixo and Kamatha. Apologies for my pronunciation. And when I saw that, I was thinking about the Chinese process of coming up with the term for God, which there was a big discussion, a conflict over whether to use Shangdi, Shen, and these are terms that are drawn from either Confucian background or just a general God's background. And so could you tell us a little bit about that translation choice, the significance of that?
Yeah, it's actually, I wanted to talk about this in my presentation, but Emma, my supervisor, was very helpful to tell me I mustn't bombard people or my listeners with too much history, because my first draft was quite historical. So I'm glad I can actually share it here. So it's very significant because the early missionaries, John van der Kemp, when he came, his translators among the Xhosa people were Khoisan. So the Khoisan and the Xhosa have mixed, it's been for so long, it's hard to tell because obviously oral cultures. But there was actually a people who were both Xhosa and Khoisan, Khoisan being the original people of South Africa. And they were the translators for the early missionaries. And they, their supreme god was Tito, which was a great chief, right? Who had supernatural powers and was then venerated, and then obviously then became a deity among the Khoi. And then Amata, on the other hand, is a great chief of the San people. And the San people are, they're also original people. They're also mixed with the Xhosa as well. And that deity was also a great chief who also had powers, and he was also venerated, and he was then approached specifically for rain. So you have rainmakers, where even Xhosa people at some point were rainmakers, and even the missionaries were asked to ask Amata for rain. But then what happened was, is that obviously John Van de Kemp, one of the first missionaries and the London Missionary Society, when they were evangelizing there, they used tickle to refer to the Christian God. So then what you have going on then is this new God being, or Christian God being called tickle. And then traditionalists or people who maintain indigenous religion and don't want to adopt Christianity, they keep Kamata. And so you sort of have these two deities now all of a sudden, which historically it is the case because it comes from both historically great chiefs, but then they were given a Christian meaning. And when Xhosa people begin to convert, they start saying that we praise Tito, right? Specifically. So almost as a way of asserting their allegiance to the Christian God. So that's colonial periods, right? And what's happening in the colonial era. But then today in our post-colonial world, you sort of have this almost this resurgence to almost make Kamata also the Christian God, and this sort of mixture between the two. But the Bible, the Xhosa Bible translation, still maintain Tito as the name to refer to the Christian God. But in popular society, in music, you see it in a lot of Xhosa music now. I mean, in Africa now, there's this huge resurgence of reclaiming our traditional religion, our identity. And you sort of see in music that people are now calling upon Kamata, you know, and even Kamata is also seen as God of the Christians. Because now it's no longer like just this battle of the two gods. I think people are understanding that the Supreme Being or our God is the same God, right? But then again, that's the debate, is it? because still in the Xhosa Bibles, Christians will maintain Tito. But in popular culture, you have this move of Tito also being Kamata. But in the church, that's not necessarily the case, right? So it's an interesting debate. Hmm. Yeah, I don't know if I'm answering you there, Charles, but
No, it's a very interesting and kind of the. So I'm wondering when you say that Dixo is used in the Bible. Do you mean it's used in the Old or the Old Testament? And if so, is it the Yahweh or is it the Elohim? Where is it used exactly? I'm curious.
It's referred to God in general in the Bible. So yeah, Tito is, I need to update that Xhosa Bible. It's 1991 now. It needs to be updated, but it's still using Tito. Right, to refer to God. So Elohim, Yahweh is not really a point of discussion, right? Because Christianity in itself is still viewed as a colonial religion when we talk about the Judeo-Christian perspective. And that's actually what I'm trying to bring in, is that when we are talking about this issue with the gods, which God? Because in the Old Testament, it's very, very clear. It's Yahweh, right? Elohim, that's the God. Not Baal, not the God of the Moabites and stuff like that. So it's a very specific thing. Hmm. It's a specific God too, right? But in Xhosa Bibles, we still just have Tito as the name. So what also you need to remember is that in 1800 already, in the 1800s, Xhosa people are translating, there's missionary stations, so Xhosa people are translating hymns, writing Bible translations and stuff, but they are using Tito to refer to God. It's how we see it. You wouldn't say Kamata in church.
I see. Very cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you for clarifying that. So Ax, as you might be aware, and many of our listeners are aware, is that World Christianity is quite a broad discipline. It includes many sub-disciplines, or it includes many different disciplines, such as Tu and I were both looking at ethnography. So we're both kind of looking at this from the anthropological perspective. But you yourself, you're from the biblical studies side. So I'm just curious. So when we talk about biblical studies, we often think about, for example, I have many friends who are in biblical studies. They're studying New Testament, for example, a Pauline letter, or they're doing Old Testament studies, one of the particular prophets. They pick a particular methodology, and you know, this is they're kind of looking forward to becoming maybe a teacher of the languages, or maybe of the Old and New Testament, something like that. But you yourself have kind of stuck into this Word Christianity group, which is quite interesting. I'm just curious what your thoughts about the intersection between Word Christianity and biblical studies is. It's a very fascinating intersection. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about it as you reside there.
Yeah. Thanks for that question. I like it very much, because that's actually part of the journey I've had as a scholar and a researcher. I was fortunate enough to study at Stellenbosch University in South Africa. And the theology faculty there, and even this biblical studies in South Africa, is very, very different, because it is participating in this post-colonial work and decolonial work of redeeming the Bible, especially from the context of how the Bible was used during colonialism, and even during apartheid, which in South Africa is basically just ended in 1994, right? So it's a very recent thing, our democracy. And so you have the biblical studies. Stellenbosch is where apartheid was created. For maybe people who don't know, apartheid was the segregation of South Africa, basically of Afrikaans, the National Party of Afrikaans movement. They basically segregated black people to live in certain areas. And they used scripture to justify themselves being the chosen people, and then black people being labeled as descendants of Ham. So this all comes, I even remember when I was studying in Stellenbosch, you'd have lectures tell you that all the staff photos hang, they would point out, those are the scholars there at the bottom who supported apartheid, and those are the ones at the top who fought against it. So in post-apartheid South Africa, you have this shift in biblical studies to interrogate the world behind the text, but to apply it to our contemporary setting, which makes sense in a country where scripture was used to oppress and it was silent in the face of oppression and injustice, right? So the lectures there are doing great work in making us understand the world behind the text. So your first 2 years, 2-3 years, you do some solid exegesis, you know. You really know all the different angles on Paul, New Testament, Old Testament stuff, in very detail, very redactionary at times, but very good to sort of see the different perspectives. But then in your third and your fourth year, they really do push you to apply what's the so what about this? How does this affect issues of the environment, race and gender? So very, very, very good program in that sense. So when I walked into my master's, then I sort of had this, okay, I've had this great education where I've learned how to balance things. So which side am I on, right? Am I on the side of, okay, we're going to look at all the historical critical approaches to this issue? And which I actually tried to do. I tried to maybe go that route, but then I found myself realizing that people read the Bible and people interpret the Bible in different ways. And especially in South Africa, the Bible literally is used for prosperity gospel in a negative sense, and also in a positive sense. It redeems people spiritually. So how, as a scholar, can I help people interpret this text responsibly? So in my master's, I started really trying to understand, okay, social political readings of John, for example. why is it important for Jesus to be the savior of the world? Okay, it just can also relate to the emperor also being the savior of the world. But then in a post-apartheid South Africa, this is important because there are the systems of apartheid. We may have had political freedom, but we still don't have economic freedom. So we need to think about how power is still present in our reality, and in the and liberation is still a struggle. So how can I use John to be liberative in a South African context? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's where the intersection lies. It's like we need to go to a point where we look at these ancient texts and we realize that people like flesh and blood, people like people that are alive, not people that are dead and are ancient that don't exist and we only see them in texts. They read this thing. And they read it negatively and positively, and it affects people's lives. So I think that's where the intersection lies, is that this Bible, which has been used to oppress people, mm-hmm. it's been used to liberate people. I mean, we see in African Americans, you know, Bible helped them overcome the injustice mm-hmm. of slavery there. You know, so there's power in this thing. So I am inspired by the works, for example, of Lisa Bounds, her recent book on African-American readings of Paul. Sort of showing a different approach on how we can sort of bring these voices of how people have had hermeneutical agency with the Bible. So yeah, I think like that redeems the Bible, because in the truth is the Bible has been used to colonize, to oppress, and to label us as other, right?
Yeah, that's great. As you were telling about your context of, you know, how you study the Bible and how the Bible is used in your context, I couldn't help but think about, you know, my own context. And then I thought about, well, you know, really, when we do biblical studies, we're really doing it, you know, in our own context. And it's all within kind of the world Christianity field. So in a sense, we're all engaged in world Christianity as we do biblical studies.
Right. I think what you said brings to mind and something that you said in your paper, which was the prophecies surrounding the mass slaughter of cattle in the 1850s, and about how you reflected on that event as, you know, a way of traditional practitioners of the animal sacrifice as a way of positioning themselves against Christian influence and missions way of life. And I don't know what came to my mind was that it seems to demonstrate for me how the Christians there are owning agency of the way they practice. And I think you mentioned about how they incorporated the notions, the motifs of resurrection to, if I may put it this way, like to prophetically imagine their triumph against poverty, famine, colonial oppression, and like you said, like liberative social political goals that was the ultimate aim of their practice. So love to hear more about that.
Yeah, you know, thanks, True, about that question. I think that is such an important point, because when I did the research for this, so the cattle killing narrative, I first heard about it orally from my grandfather, right?
Could you tell us a bit about like the context, because we have read the paper, but I think others may not know what
exactly. Yeah. Okay. I'll definitely do that then. Yeah. So I asked my grandfather, why do we live here? And the question is because we live in more droughtful areas. The bare areas were taken by the British. And he would always say, no, it's because of Unxawuse. And so I was like, okay, what do you mean? And Unxawuse is this young prophetess woman who made this prophecy in the 1854, who said that if Xhosa people sacrifice all their cattle and don't cultivate their crop, the ancestors will rise again and help them defeat the impending mm-hmm. British colonial force. And then there will be peace on the land, and the famine or the epidemic of cattle, because there was a lung sickness epidemic on the cattle, and they were dying. This arrived from ships from actually Holland, in fact, when they were when the Dutch were coming down to South Africa. So what was happening during this time is you have the British Cape Colony trying to expand its territory away more further east to the eastern frontier where Xhosa people were. So they kept getting more land and more land beyond Cape Town, which was the base and the port they were operating from. And so this was taking away more land from the Xhosa. And so there was this, so there was a little piece of land that was still independent, but most of the Xhosa people's territory had become British territory. And so this prophecy comes in the Xhosa region that was still independent. And then there's this epidemic of lung sickness. And so obviously during this time, I mean, land territory expansion comes with wars. It's not just people are, hey, we want more land. People are fighting. So there's a whole 100-year war that happened between 1779 to 1880. So this prophecy is literally towards the end of this war between the Xhosa people and the British. And fighting obviously wasn't working, right? Mm-hmm. And so this prophecy arrives at a time of great anxiety, defeat, despair. Now the cattle are even getting sick. What do we do? And then here comes this prophecy. And she's a prophetess, right? From a whole line of prophets who are sort of opposing this cultural erasure that Christianity was perpetuating. This moving away, wearing clothes and not using your blanket, moving away from traditional practices, taking one wife, you know, this basically this assault on indigenous religion, where you then must get educated because you must be civilized and be part of the empire, right? So conversion was political. So this act of mass sacrifice sort of tries to act as a way of, we can still be who we are. If we do this, the British will be defeated. We will win. Our ancestors will rise again, and we will win this war, and things will be better on the land. There will be peace. The cattle will be healed and everything. But it didn't work. But what was interesting for me is how they took the concept of resurrection and made it their own, and how resurrection was placed in their own cosmology, their own religious cosmology of how this sacrifice will appease and ensure a resurrection of our ancestors. So it's not just appeasing them to be happy and then our lives to be better. It's appeasing them so they rise again and fight with us. It's such a it's powerful, you know, how they were reimagining their own indigenous religious beliefs as a way of fighting oppression, even though it didn't work, but it was a cultural protest for me that shows the agency that even in the 1850s that Xhosa people had to not allow this impending threat take away who they are. So, yeah.
Oh, thank you, Ax. That's a great explanation. Just moving back to biblical studies again, and this is really going to draw upon your biblical study side, but I'm curious about I come from a culture that does not do sacrifices, so it seems quite interesting to me. It's very easy to understand text, for example, say like Hebrews 10:18, where it says, and where these have been forgiven, sacrifice or sin is no longer necessary, where these is referring to sins and lawless deeds. And it's talking about, you know, where when Jesus' sacrifice is done, there's no need for sacrifice anymore. How would you understand this text given a culture of sacrifice and the importance of sacrifice?
Thanks for your question, Charles. Yeah, like I'll actually take that question in two. So I'll deal with the first part because there's two levels to your question. The first answer I would say is there's actually a lot of research on animal sacrifice in antiquity by scholars, which is very interesting. And I want to just mention one is David Ulechi wrote recently a book of the end of animal sacrifice, And he argues that the reason why animal sacrifice ended is because the in the canonization of Christianity in the fourth century, the elite that decided the canon picked scriptures that supported the notion to end sacrifice. But he argues that not all early Christians were opposed to animal sacrificial practice, and that you can actually devise that there's actually, there are people who, there are texts, early Christian texts that also didn't make the canon, by the way, but the early Christian texts that said that that have an ideal form of sacrifice. So and then there are those that advocate, there's a group of texts that advocate for an ideal form of sacrifice, so an ideal vision of what animal sacrifice should be, and then there are groups that say that sacrifice must end, and Hebrews would fall under that. Hebrews is clearly a text that is opposed to animal sacrifice, and it is it's basically advocating for that. So yeah, and there's also a very interesting book also by Strozem, Guy Strozem, and he actually he also talks about the end of sacrifice, and he shows how the reason why like animal sacrifice that so he gives like a background. You could even they're written in two different times, but for me I sort of see a connection there. Because Strozem, he says that Christianity, from the early fathers onwards, took a more Greco-Roman philosophical perspective. And they moved more and more away from the Jewish way of thinking. They adopted more Greco-Roman philosophies and led to a spiritualization of sacrifice and of religious belief, which was always going to be set up to move away from the right. So yeah, like so that's the first part of the question, I think, to answer like that, is that there's these just perspectives, and that it's more in antiquity, it's more nuanced like that. You mean you have emperors like the Emperor Justin, the apostate, who wants to advocate for the return of traditional religions, the return of sacrifice in the 300s. And then he's killed, and he even promises to rebuild the temple of the Jews so that they can offer sacrifices again, because it was destroyed in 70 AD. But then he dies, and then this, because he's trying to oppose this Christianization, which is highly spiritual. And it's sort of, this whole spiritualization of sacrifice, which even Jonathan Clowen speaks about. So yeah, there's that going on. But then in terms of the cultural element, which is the second level, and how I would read Hebrews. So there's a lot of work by African scholars who talk about enculturation, hermeneutics. So how do we enculturate the gospel in our cultural context? So in this sense, I mean, Hebrews is quite clear here. If it's advocating for the end of animal sacrifice, because Jesus' sacrifice should be upheld. But I think culturally that calls for a transformation. So that means we need cultures that do animal sacrifice would need to transform the sacrificial practice in light of the revelation of Christ, because Jesus' sacrifice sort of replaces, or even I don't like replacement because it assumes the end, but I would say that's why I prefer transformation, because you even see in the Hebrews how everything Christ's sacrifice is juxtaposed with Jewish sacrificial system. Like burnt offerings are made daily every day, but the sacrifice of Jesus atones for everyone's sins once and for all. It's almost like, you know, it's like a dichotomy. Okay, you did that, you had to do that every day, but Jesus' sacrifice like does it once and for all. So in other words, like rhetorically, it's like it's superior. So it's transforming cultural animal sacrificial practice to recognize Jesus' sacrifice and its power, you know, and how it transforms the right to be more Christocentric, if it makes sense. That doesn't mean abandonment. That doesn't mean stopping it. It just means it has a different symbolic meaning.
Yes, I understand. That makes perfect sense. It's quite easy to skip over that kind of sacrificial text coming from a cultural background where really sacrifices aren't prevalent, right?
Yeah. And but it's not. I like these scholars who are writing this stuff. They're Americans, some of them, right? So, and one Strozem, I think, is French. So. Thank you to Susan who translated the book. I like their work because they're looking at it without, they're using the text that they have, right? And it's so interesting to read their work, and you sort of see the history. For me, I'm so fascinated by the history of sacrifice, like to see how sacrifice changes, grows, is done differently for different reasons, has some different symbolic elements. But it's interesting for me to see how it progresses and how even scholars who don't have it culturally, how they investigate it and what they choose to focus on.
Well, I think that's all the time that we have for the episode for today. Thank you, Axe, for coming in to this episode and for sharing about your research. I really enjoyed learning more about it, especially I think it has several themes and questions that are quite relevant and close to my own research. So we'll be looking forward to how your research develops onward from here. Thanks, X.
Thank you for having me. It was so much fun. And thank you for the opportunity of sharing my research and inviting me on this podcast. And thank you to Chu and Chao for having me here. And I really appreciate your time and your very thought-provoking questions. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much, X. That will be the end of this episode. We are working very hard on getting a couple more episodes to you guys. So hanging for that, look out for that. They will be quite exciting. And I'm sure we'll have many more interesting discussions. Thank you so much. Take care and have a safe day.